You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The Middle East since the new year has been in crisis after the US launched a drone strike in Baghdad on the 3rd and killing Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, as well as a popular figure in the country. Even though US President Donald Trump justified the decision by saying that the strike was to prevent further attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, the killing of Soleimani caused an uproar in both Iran and Iraq, with the Iraqi parliament in Baghdad voting in favor to expel all foreign troops, while Tehran insisting the attack was a breach of its sovereignty. In retaliation, Iran pulled out of the nuclear deal, and 5 days after the initial strike, they launched missile attacks on US air bases in Iraq. But hours after the strike, an Ukrainian International Airlines flight bound for Kiev crashed after taking off from Tehran, killing all 176 on board, with the majority being Canadian and Iranian. Initially blaming the attack as technical error, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani admitted 3 days later after the crash the plane has been shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile, describing it as an, quote, unforgivable mistake. Now protests are ongoing against the Iranian government, its supreme leader Ali Khamenei, and the Revolutionary Guards, who were believed to have shot down the plane. Now, what will this current situation in the Middle East change on US foreign policy and regional security against terrorism in the region, especially against the Islamic State? I talked to Paul Buchanan, a former intelligence and defense policy analyst and consultant to the US government security agencies, who specializes in matters of comparative politics, international relations, and security. And he is currently the director of the 36th Parallel, a geopolitical risk and strategic assessment consultancy.
Can the regional allies trust the United States to hold firm on its commitments? Because certainly the pullback of U.S. troops from Kurdish-held areas in an explicit deal made with President Erdogan in Turkey that allowed him to then come in to those Turkish areas and basically engage in a policy of ethnic cleansing certainly doesn't augur well for the trust between the United States and other allies in the region. Although the Kurds have always been on the receiving end of betrayal from the United States for years. You know, we have to remember the Kurds have always been the U.S.'s best allies in the conflicts in Iraq, dating back to the Saddam Hussein days. And yet they're continually left in the lurch by the United States because bigger players are involved. And none of the bigger players in the region want the Kurds to have an autonomous, independent state. Which is the bottom line for the Kurds in both Syria and Iraq. And so the United States cuts deals with bigger powers and leaves the Kurds to fend for themselves. But more importantly, the United States has a ring of permanent military bases throughout the Middle East, and they're not going to go anywhere because there are lease agreements with the host countries, and a lot of these agreements are long-term. For example, the agreement to host the U.S. 7th Fleet in Bahrain is on, I believe, a 99-year lease. And so it would be very difficult for the United States to renege on its contractual obligations, nor does it want to in the case of these major fixed assets. But, for example, the relationship between the United States and Iraq in the wake of the assassination of General Soleimani, certainly could change. The current U.S. president has said that he wants to withdraw U.S. troops from the Middle East. That betrayed a certain level of ignorance during the campaign, but he now realizes that that'll be easier said than done. And if the Iraqi government decides that they don't want the current U.S. presence in Iraq, then it's very possible that either the Americans will leave, or more likely, they will try to negotiate a new status of forces agreement, the so-called SOFAs, which are the agreements the U.S. has with various host countries, to reduce the U.S. footprint but maintain a presence there for two reasons. One, the fight with ISIS is not over. ISIS is regrouping in Anbar province, that is the Sunni-controlled western province that borders on Iraq, excuse me, borders on Syria, into which the ISIS fighters have fled once their caliphate was defeated in Syria. And two, because the United States forces provide a buffer between Sunni-controlled areas of Iraq and Shia-controlled areas, and through the Shia, the Iranian presence in Iraq, which is considerable and is growing as a result of the U.S. intervention, beginning with the ouster of Saddam Hussein, and undoubtedly will grow in the wake of this recent tit-for-tat between the U.S. and Iran, because we must remember Iraq is a Shia-majority country that was dominated for years by a minority Sunni government in the form of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party regime. But demographically, the Shia are dominant in that region, and quite frankly, given the history, the modern history of Iraq, the Shia are quite homicidal when it comes to their Sunni counterparts. So the United States provides a buffer in the form of its troops between these two contending factions, and I doubt very much that any Iraqi government, which right now is Shia-dominated, will want to see their country descend into a bloodbath should the United States withdraw, or should Iran enter more visibly into the internal affairs of Iraq. So all of which is to say, the United States cannot be trusted on its shorter-term commitments, but it can be trusted on its longer-term commitments simply because there are more permanent interests at play on the part of the United States and its various host allies. And then there are financial and other obligations that work both ways, which would diminish and make it virtually impossible a quick withdrawal from the U.S. In many places.
And could we? But when we are talking about ISIS now, could ISIS or any other terrorist organizations take advantage of the current situation in Iran or Iraq and will create a resurgence for themselves?
Yes, absolutely, and that's in fact part of what's going on. We have to remember that ISIS originated from the Sunni-controlled areas of Iraq. In fact, their military commanders originally were Saddam Hussein's military commanders who had fled the Americans, went into the Sunni-controlled areas in Anbar, were protected by tribal chieftains, and then launched a much bigger campaign to gain control of Iraq in the first instance, but later Syria. So that's their homeland, and they've retreated to that homeland. The physical caliphate was defeated by the coalition, but many ISIS fighters, including their new commander after the death of al-Baghdadi, have gone into Anbar, where they are receiving the protection of the tribal leadership in many parts of Anbar. And they're reconstituting as part of their campaign to resurrect their conflict, and that conflict is going to begin once again inside Iraq. So there is a very distinct danger that ISIS will reemerge strengthened by any of these conflicts, both between Shia and Sunni in Iraq, but also between the United States and Iran, because when the United States is preoccupied with Iran and is basically saber-rattling at Iran, it is not paying as much attention to the resurgence of ISIS. There are only, although the U.S. is a very, very mighty military power, it still is stretched pretty thin on the ground in Iraq. And so it is quite possible that we'll see a resurgence of ISIS. And if we do, that will exacerbate the sectarian divide within Iraq, which will then will become the epicenter of yet another sectarian war between these extremist Wahhabists and Salafists and everybody else. But we always must remember that the fight that ISIS has taken to the world begins with Shia Islam. The fight is mainly between Sunni and Shia Islam as far as the extremists are concerned. The West is a foil. The West is something that the Wahhabists and Salafists use for recruitment purposes, and they obviously don't want a Western presence in on sacred lands and a region that they consider to be sacred as a whole. And so for them, this has become very convenient in that now they can isolate the fight in the first instance to Iraq along sectarian grounds, which have long historical lineages, and that fight will include a fight against Iran. It poses a serious quandary for the United States, because if ISIS starts attacking Iranian backed militias in Iraq, militias that U.S. Has accused of killing U.S. personnel in Iraq and elsewhere, what does the United States do? Does it back ISIS in its campaign against these militias, or does it try to fight both ISIS and the militias at the same time with a limited amount of troops on the ground in Iraq? And that doesn't seem like a salvageable proposition. So it'll be interesting to see, both diplomatically and militarily, what the United States does, particularly since this is an election year in the United States, and U.S. presidents in general have always used foreign policy to bolster their re-election chances, most unhappily by picking a fight with some very obvious foe in order to rally patriotic sentiment around their re-election. And that's exactly what Trump has done here by picking a fight with Iran that we now know is not justifiable under international law nor American law, because the threat posed by General Soleimani was neither imminent nor as, how could I put it, as grave as the United States initially made it out to be. There was no imminent threat, as it turns out. They just wanted him dead so that they could make a point to the Iranians. And unfortunately, since it was not justified by any imminent military logic, then what it was essentially was a targeted assassination, an extrajudicial killing that is illegal under international law. So the U.S. has, the U.S. president in this instance has engaged in a time-honored practice of picking a fight with a weaker foe during an election year. But the Iranians are smart in that they know that they can't reciprocate in kind, and they have their own troubles to worry about. So everything will remain status quo until November of this year, when the election is held. If Trump wins, we can expect more of the same and possibly an escalation of hostilities with Iran. If Trump loses, then it is very possible that his successor, who would be a Democrat, would recalibrate the U.S. position in the Middle East and possibly begin a drawdown of U.S. troops to let the Iraqis some degree of self-determination, with assurances given that if the Iranians push their influence too far into Iraq, or if they push the sectarian conflicts between Shia and Sunni too far, that the United States will return in order to reestablish that buffer that I mentioned earlier. And it remains open to see what the relationship will be with the Kurds will be, but I would imagine that a successor administration would attempt to bolster the alliance with the Kurds and do something diplomatically to withdraw the Turkish presence, which includes both Turkish troops and Turkish-backed militias in northern Syria and northern Iraq.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.